Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. There are three causes on the oral submission docket this morning. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Emil J. Amberboy and others versus Societe de Bon Provide and others. Certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Royce Graff, Deborah Lynn Graff, Bobby Houseman, and Betty Houseman versus Brett Beard and Dorothy Beard from Bexar County. And Westgate Limited and others versus the State of Texas and the City of Austin from Travis County. The times are allotted for argument in each of these causes have been previously announced. Council are aware of those. The petitioners or appellants may make a provision with our bailiff to save a certain amount of this time for rebuttal argument if you desire to do so. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these oral submissions, and we'll finish the submission docket before our break for lunch. The court is ready to hear argument from appellants in Amberboy versus Societe.
May it please the court, Mr. Edward K. White will present argument for appellant. Mr. White has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm here this morning to persuade this court to enforce the existing law of the state of Texas. My very able opponent is here to persuade the court to change the law of the state of Texas. Judge Dewey of the Fifth Circuit has certified the question to you as follows. Is a promissory note requiring interest to be charged at a rate that can be determined only by reference to a bank's published prime rate, a negotiable instrument as defined by the Texas Uniform Commercial Code. Current Texas law is that prime rate notes are not negotiable instruments. Turning to the Uniform Commercial Code, we're referencing specifically 3.104, form of negotiable instruments, and I quote, any writing to be a negotiable instrument within this chapter must contain an unconditional promise or order to pay a sum certain in money. Official comment one, the section 3.106, which is the sum certain section, reads in part, it is sufficient that at any time of payment, the holder is able to determine the amount then payable from the instrument itself. The computation must be one which can be made from the instrument itself without reference to any outside source. And this section does not make negotiable a note payable with interest, quote, at the current rate, unquote.
Counsel, under 3.106, it does not affect the negotiability of an instrument if the note is payable in foreign exchange. And a party needs to consult what the current exchange rate is through some outside source to determine how much to pay on that note. Is that correct?
I would expect so.
And how is that any different from what the appellees are arguing here? Consulting an outside source that would allow some reasonable commercial certainty in ascertaining the amount due.
Actually, I don't know the policy reason behind carving out that specific exception. Exceptions are carved out, and the legislature has carved that one out. I'm afraid I don't know why they carved that one out.
Is it any different? Is the question.
I believe that, I've not reflected on the issue, and I don't believe I can respond intelligently. I accepted that as a legislative exception, specifically stated, and did not question it. I do know, however, that there is no legislative exception for prime rates, and that under official comment one, it is very plain and clear that a prime rate is determined outside the four corners of the document, and there's no legislative exception for prime rates.
You'd also agree that under 3.106, that if the note is payable at a stated discount rate, which cannot be ascertained from the face of the document itself, that does not defeat negotiability either.
Well, 3.106A3 of the legislation does, in fact, specifically carve that exception out.
And how is it different?
I'm not sure. It is different in that the legislature carved it up, not the courts, and it is specifically carved up.
Is there anything on the face of the Uniform Commercial Code sections we're concerned with that negates reference to a variable interest rate published by some commercial entity?
Yes, I believe there is.
Okay.
Now, I know there's a reasonable debate on the issue of official comment one as to whether it is adopted with the legislation or not. Let's assume that it's not adopted as statutory language. Let's be conservative on that. Nevertheless, the drafters of the Uniform Commercial Code, in fact, the National Uniform Commercial Code, in presenting that to the Texas legislature, included comment one, and the Texas legislature, in adopting the legislation, included comment one, and it's right here in all the official publications, and it may not technically be part of the law, but it certainly is technically the official comment on interpretation of the law, expressly for the purpose of assisting you and me, so that we don't have commercial uncertainty.
When this comment was written 30 years ago, do you have any idea about what the prevailing banking practice was about these floating interest notes?
Interestingly enough, in 1966, I myself had a primary interest note. As you can imagine, that was related to school. I do know as a fact that primary interest notes were prevalent among my fellow students trying to make it through college. Fortunately, we had an advantage on our primary notes, but we did have primary notes. Now, whether in fact 22% or 56% or whatever, I don't believe that's before the court today, and in fact, I don't know. As a matter of Fed-wide judicial notice, I don't know what the practice was, other than the fact that I personally had a prime rate note in 1966.
The note in this case, which is quoted in the certification of the question, refers to lender. Is that the Bank Privée?
The French Bank, Société de Banque Privée.
And that's the lender referred to in the note?
Yes. Interestingly enough, Société de Banque Privée does not have a prime rate of interest. In fact, no French bank has a prime rate of interest.
Apparently, it was not difficult to determine what rate should be referenced, because the parties have indeed stipulated as to the interest rate that would apply here.
We have not. Judge Dewey took considerable liberty with that. What we have indicated is that since the French bank does not have a prime rate of interest, they picked one out of the air. In fact, they picked several out of the air, and they have sent down bills to everyone based on a prime rate that I believe they picked Allied Bank for a while, and now they picked some other bank that we don't know what they picked. There is no prime rate.
But that's really irrelevant to us, because we're only supposed to answer this question.
Short of him asking the question, I would not have raised it.
On page 4 of the appellant's brief, it says the applicable rate of interest, however, is not an issue as it has been stipulated to by the parties. Is that an error?
That's Judge Dewey's comment, I believe.
Well,
this is the
brief of appellants.
Well, it sounds to me like a quote from Judge Dewey, but we did not ever stipulate as an interest rate. In fact, one of the fundamental bases of the underlying suit is that part of the fraud on us was this notion that the lender would be a bank that does not have a prime rate. But returning to the issue, which is the certified question before us, the published prime rate issue, Chemical Bank versus D3J Associates is a federal district court case in Maryland. I only cite it for the one proposition, quote, this court cannot overlook the overwhelming authority holding that variable interest rates are not to be considered a sum certain for the purpose of determining negotiability of a note. The overwhelming authority. Now, turning to Texas law, I filed this morning a case that just yesterday became official. Is a case I call the Dillard case. It is a case that was decided right here in this courtroom. It is a Texas Court of Appeals at Austin. It is a lender's prime rate plus 2% case. And very interesting that the Texas Court of Appeals at Dallas and the Texas Court of Appeals at Austin, 7 days from each other, came to exactly the same conclusion on exactly the same primary rate issue. So in the Gibbs versus Bank One case, And in the Dillard versus NCNB case, Dallas and Austin came to exactly the same conclusion, and these are very current. August 30th, 1991, September 5th, 1991. Quote, we should first say that the note was not a negotiable instrument susceptible of endorsement in the strict sense of the word. The attribute of negotiability was defeated by the provision in the note for a variable interest rate measured by the lender's prime rate plus 2%, because this precluded the calculation of a sum certain in money. The Gibbs versus Bank One is a case on a prime rate note plus a base rate note, and frankly, I'm not sure I know what the difference is between a prime rate and a base rate. Both of them are determined by the bank itself. Quote, because the amounts due under the notes are not a sum certain and can only be determined from sources outside of the notes are not negotiable instruments. Interestingly enough, NCNB appeared this morning by way of brief. Filed the 12th, which is today. The Dillard case was Dillard versus NCNB. In a check with the clerk's office, they did not motion for rehearing. They did not file a writ with this court, and yet they're here this morning at the last minute. In Gibbs versus Bank One, check with the clerk's office, no motion for rehearing, no writ. So, moving along, gas reclamation. This is a New York Federal District Court case. Very interesting. The fact situation is very much like ours. Promissory notes by investors, indemnity agreements by investors. Texas law applies. Judge Sand ruled that since the calculation of interest due on the notes requires reference to the prime rate then being charged by a specified bank, a source outside the instrument itself, the notes are not negotiable instruments. 1990. Judge Sand. 1989, Lexington Insurance versus Gray. This is a bank's base rate case. Lexington Insurance versus Gray. We note also that since the Mississippi Lofts note provides for a variable interest rate tied to a fluctuating base rate established by the bank, the note apparently is not a negotiable instrument as that term is defined in the Uniform Commercial Code. 1989, Federal District Court. In New York, National Union versus Alexander, this is a 2% over prime case. These are all prime or base rate cases. The court held that the note was not non-negotiable for failure to state a sum certain within Section 104, because the amount could only be determined from sources outside the instrument. Similarly, the rate of interest in the Group 1 defendant's notes can only be calculated by reference to a source outside the instrument, the prime rate then being charged by the Cullen Frost Bank of Dallas. Accordingly, the interest provision renders these notes non-negotiable. In the 1966 Texas Supreme Court case of Brazos River Authority versus Carr, this was a bond case. This was a River Authority bond case, and the bonds had a coupon for 2.5% extra bonus interest if the funds were available. Interesting, the historical reference, when they declared it non-negotiable, quote, it is clear under both the negotiable instruments law that preceded the Uniform Commercial Code and the Uniform Commercial Code, the bonds and coupons in question are not negotiable instruments. An instrument to be negotiable must conform to the following requirements. It must contain an unconditional promise or order to pay at some certain in money. So in 1966, and I'm not indicating that the fact situation is parallel, but in 1966, the banks were on notice that variable interest notes or bonds or debt obligations were at risk in terms of holder in due course status. Now, there is a case called Tannenbaum out of the Eighth Circuit that purports to apply Texas law, which is the only case that purports to apply Texas law that holds that a LIBOR rate note, not a prime rate note, but a LIBOR rate note is a negotiable instrument.
I don't know what that is.
London Interbank Rate. It's like the Fed funds rate in the United States. LIBOR is a British government declared rate. So what you have is you have Tannenbaum declaring that an officially published government rate falls outside of the non-negotiability, which is the general rule of the Uniform Commercial Code of Texas. Now, in so declaring, they cite one 1904 Missouri law case, which was an Eighth Circuit case. And by this time, in 1989, there was a lot of law in Texas, no citation whatsoever to Texas case law. There is a citation to the statute itself, and then after that, there's only one case. I would point out a danger in this case. I mean a danger, not to me, but to our system. The court apparently had no evidence before it of what was the pivotal fact in that case. And I quote, "We agree with First National Bank's suggestion that generally accepted commercial practices would be severely and adversely affected should we find that reference in standard published indices would render an instrument non-negotiable." Well, since 1989, there's been a whole lot happening in the banking industry, but I know of no one who's blamed negotiability or non-negotiability of promissory notes as being even an element in contribution.
Well, but doesn't it just stand to reason that if a note is non-negotiable, that impairs its worth?
I don't disagree. If a note is negotiable, it strips the makers of their Texas contract law defenses and counterclaims.
So if it's non-negotiable, it's bound to have some negative impact on its worth.
As a theory, I agree with you. My comment was that in terms of the impact in the commercial markets, which is what he's talking about, a severe adverse effect. No one could demonstrate that today, and certainly the appellees have not. There is no demonstration whatsoever in this court today that it had a twit of effect, particularly since in 1966, the eagle-eyed banking lobby could have realized from Brazos that they were going to have a problem on this very issue. In 1966, and by the way, this case came down 27 days after the effective date of the Uniform Commercial Code. They had comment one. Comment one's clear as a bell. They have Brazos River Authority.
Your time has expired. I don't believe that's an answer to the question. Are there any questions? All right. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. J. Eugene Clement will present argument for appellee.
May it please the court. I represent the Society of the Bank of Privé. I don't warrant the pronunciation any more than the court does. The bank, however, is the purchaser of $2.5 million worth of notes that the appellants in this case wished the bank to buy. They affirmatively solicited the bank to buy these notes after formation of the limited partnership. They agreed as Exhibit 3B to the brief we filed makes clear this is a post-purchase estoppel letter.
But there again, these facts...
These facts are irrelevant to the issue before us. My only point, Your Honor, is to note, and I'll do it briefly, in their estoppel letters, each appellant said the obligations represented by the note shall be paid in full, irrespective of any set-off claim, counterclaim, defense, or other right. Where I'm headed, Your Honor, is the interpretive guidelines suggest that this court and all courts, this is not a rigid statutory construction situation. The UCC was adopted in Texas with perhaps more forethought than usual to the notion that courts are going to have to expand and modernize it from time to time in order to keep it current with commercial practice. They are supposed to keep it current with custom and usage and with the agreement of the parties. And my point, Your Honor, is that in this case, the appellants are here asking you to frustrate the agreement of the parties, to absolve them of the estoppel letter that they signed, and in what name are they asking you to do it? In the name of rigidifying...
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Would you please respond to the question Judge Cornyn asked the other side earlier regarding the statutory exception that is carved out. There is a statutory exception to the variable interest rate issue as far as negotiability is concerned, and now you come before us when there is a statutory exception carved out in one area and ask us to carve a judicial exception.
That's correct, Your Honor. Actually, I'm not asking you to carve an exception, nor would I quite agree with you that these are statutory exceptions. What I'd suggest to you, Your Honor, is that they are examples of what renders a note negotiable despite the apparent four corners rule of comment one. And I'd suggest to you, Your Honor, that's a reasonably fundamental difference. We are asking for the law to be interpreted differently, but we're not asking you to reverse any section of the existing Texas UCC. We're pointing out to you that you're not straitjacketed by comment one. The appellant's whole position is that comment one, which is merely an interpretive rule, this court in Romo 2 decades ago made it absolutely clear that you are not bound by comments. They're only interpretive aids. As Justice Cornyn pointed out, that's a 25-year-old comment, and it has no relationship to commercial reality today. My worthy opponent, Mr. White, may have had a variable rate note in 1966 when he was a student. He was one of relatively few. The literature that we attached and of which this court can take judicial notice since they're official publications of the U.S. government indicates that the growth of variable interest rate notes has been prodigious to the extent that some 70% of all commercial paper is now variable interest rate notes. An amicus brief filed in this case will demonstrate that now 27 states have either through statute codifying existing law or by interpretation of their state Supreme Courts, join the ranks of those states which recognize the negotiability of variable interest rate notes.
Well, with reference to these more recent developments, if we answer this question as you have urged us to do, is it necessary or desirable for us to, in that opinion, disapprove both the Dallas Court of Appeals case and the Austin Court of Appeals case that counsel referenced in his argument?
I don't think you need to disapprove them at all. First place, when you look at Dillard and read it not even very closely, it's apparent that the reference to variable interest rates notes being non-negotiable was the purest dicta. The holding of the court was that the court cannot grant a summary judgment to the plaintiff and sua sponte dismiss the defendant's counterclaim without another motion for summary judgment. It then moved on to the question whether the bank had proved it was a holder in due course. And in the course of discussing this question of the adequacy of proof, the court said in a very offhand fashion, the plaintiff was, we should first say that the note was not a negotiable instrument susceptible of endorsement in the strict sense of the word. The attribute of negotiability was defeated by the provision in the note for a variable interest rate, and they cite the same cases, Brazos River Authority and Lexington Insurance Company, which counsel cites to you. It was not necessary to the decision. You don't need to reverse that one. As to Gibbs versus Bank One, that issue is not before you. If the court was wrong, and if it comes before you, you'll have an opportunity to reverse it. If the court was not wrong, and no motion for new trial was filed, and it does not come here by way of application for writ, this court need not take notice of it. It will simply be reversed by the action of this court because it misconstrued the law. If you go back and look at the cases that purportedly support the appellant's position, you will not find one that reasons through the policy behind the UCC and holds a variable interest rate notes are non-negotiable. They cited Walker to you in their first brief. That was an opinion that was withdrawn. They quoted with pride from Sunbelt Savings versus Montrose. All the parties in Montrose have filed amicus briefs with this court because the Fifth Circuit en banc vacated the opinion they cited and is awaiting word from this court as to what Texas law is. And then they cite Brazos River Authority as if that's going to tell you something. In the first place, it was mistakenly decided under Section 3 since it involved bonds, which are governed by a separate section of the UCC. In the second place, no question that it was decided rightly. In that case, The interest rate was only, the interest was only to be paid if the underlying entity for which the bonds had been sold made a profit.
I'm not sure you answered my question a while ago, and I'm still a little confused. I'd still like to have you address it.
Yes, Justice.
Judge Cornyn and opposing counsel talked as if that was a carved out exception. You tell me that it wasn't an exception, and that we are at liberty to adapt the code to prevailing commercial practices.
You're free to, excuse me.
If that's the case, if we have that latitude, why was it necessary to carve out what the, if it's not an exception, tell me what it is.
Examples of what will not defeat the negotiability of a note, despite the fact that the Four Corners rule would superficially appear to render the note non-negotiable. I'd submit to you, and I'm sorry I don't have the language of the section, read the section. It is not mandatory. It does not say these are exceptions to the rule, because the rule isn't in section 3.104. The rule that appellants ask you to codify into the law of Texas is comment. It's comment one, which is the Four Corners statement that if you can't ascertain every payment due on a note within the four corners of the document, it can't be negotiable.
Is it true that most courts and other jurisdictions which have considered this issue have resolved it contrary to the argument you're making in this case?
No, I don't believe that's true, Your Honor. Very few cases have considered it at any degree of depth. And a number of cases, and it, first place, Goss, the clearest and most directly relevant case out of the Oklahoma Supreme Court, was flat statutory construction by the state Supreme Court. Most other states have adopted modifications of the UCC that codify, that's expressly in the face of the legislation, purport to codify the existing law, to clarify confusion as to existing law.
Well, the basic question is, why should we do it rather than the legislature acting?
There was a statute proposed in the legislature which was not to change the law. That statute specifically said it was to clarify existing law because there is no four square precedent for you here in Texas. There is no existing Texas law except what the legislature said was undoubtedly the policy direction that all the courts are going. I think that this court is invited in the first place by the statute itself. The UCC is a statute which specifically envisages and requests guidance from the courts in order to keep the statute modern.
Are you
referring
to the defeated House bill?
I'm referring, it wasn't defeated, Your Honor. It never came to a vote.
Well, it was withdrawn from...
It just never got reached.
Okay.
It was filed by, I believe, Justice Representative Smith.
And you say, you in your brief say that we should not derive or try to divine any kind of legislative intent from that action.
I agree, Your
Honor.
But
yet you want us to take, accept your argument that that merely was a clarification and not a change.
Well, that, on the face of the statute, that's what it said it was. Now, whether or not that's binding on you, obviously it's not. I mean, that was what Representative Smith put on his bill, and it may or may not have been accurate. However, it is significant when counsel for the appellants tell you that this is somehow proof that Texas has rejected the notion of variable interest rate notes being negotiable. Texas has not rejected, in the first place, it never came to a vote, in the second place, the statute itself purported to clarify existing law, not change the law.
The National Conference of Commissioners of Uniform State Laws and the American Law Institute have together suggested that this these provisions be amended so that it would clearly specify that variable interest rates do not render an instrument non-negotiable.
That's exactly true. That clearly
why doesn't that show change in the law rather than a clarification?
Because the UCC specifically says it was merely clarifying the law as it is evolving. Obviously, a model code is not law anywhere. The model UCC is just what's held up to courts and legislatures for guidance as to where commercial law is headed.
The UCC was preceded by the NIL, the Negotiable Instruments Law, and have not, over the history of both these statutes, there have been numerous court interpretations to clarify.
Oh, unquestionably. The NIL was much more definitively interpreted because it itself purported to be more definitive. The UCC has had a lot more court cases in which the courts have stepped into the picture because they've been invited to do so by the legislature. The very terms of the statute under Section 1.102 ask the courts to assist the legislature in keeping the statute current with modern commercial practice. Texas cannot afford in this competitive world to let itself slip back, and our legislature was wise enough when it adopted this law to take provision for the fact that we're going to have to move swiftly to keep things current. We're not asking for a change here, as appellants say. We think we're only asking you to clarify, as the legislature failed to do in the last session, what the existing law is. And if you look at the precedents that have been cited to you, one by one, not one four square holds that variable interest rate notes are non-negotiable. We're cited to cases from the Southern District of New York purportedly applying Texas law. Those have been reversed by Federal Savings Bank versus Bogoanacour, a case the party almost as hard to pronounce as my own client's name. They purport to apply Texas law without any discussion. The only case, other than the Illinois District Court case, which seriously discusses the policy behind the UCC, is Goss out of the Oklahoma Supreme Court. And there, the Supreme Court of Oklahoma did exactly what I'm asking you to do here today, and that was to interpret existing the Oklahoma UCC law to include variable interest rate notes as negotiable. Not as an exception, although in a sense it is, but clearly as the appropriate way to go to keep Oklahoma competitive. To respond to your question, Your Honor, to respond further, hopefully, when you talk about a note, it's a living, breathing thing. I mean, payments are made monthly. If the appellant's rule were strictly applied, every time an advance payment was made on a note, it would cease to be negotiable because you couldn't ascertain that fact on the four corners of the instrument. Every time a payment's missed, all of a sudden, the note would become non-negotiable because the four corners rule would say you can't check the loan ledger to see whether or not it's current. The examples that we contend the UCC gave, such as taxes, attorney's fees, which obviously can only be testified to after default and after the matters in litigation, these are examples of situations where this living note that constantly changes on a month-to-month basis must be kept commercially marketable, despite these aberrations which do not frustrate commercial certainty.
What about the reference here is to the in the certified question to a bank's published prime rate? Would it make any difference to your argument if this was a private rate or one, I guess that's probably not well stated, but a rate that was not readily ascertainable from opening up the financial page of the newspaper or reading it in the Wall Street Journal?
Well, I suspect you could go down interpretive trails as to how far you need to go to find commercial certainty. As you pointed out, the parties have stipulated it in this case.
By the way, do you think the parties have stipulated
it? I think Cullen did in its brief. I don't recall a formal stipulation being signed. Unquestionably, counsel for the appellants argued in the Fifth Circuit that there was no difficulty in ascertaining what the interest rate was on these notes. True, a French bank does not have a prime rate, but the rep office in New York for this bank incorporated the Citibank prime rate, and that was the prime rate to which they had reference. Not important terribly in this case, because you're not really asked to decide that. I agree with you. It's simpler if it's a Wall Street Journal reported index or one of the major nationwide banks' commercial rates that is reported in the financial press. That's simpler. But I think, Your Honor, you're borrowing a problem from tomorrow that you don't need to resolve today in terms of how much publication, how easy it has to be to get the prime rate. Obviously, the prime rate at Texas Commerce Bank is going to be different in terms of ease of access than the prime rate at the First National Bank of Libertyville. In this situation, Your Honor, I really can't close without commending to you the importance of the policy task which you've been invited by the legislature in the statute to perform here. It is important to the economy of Texas that Texas deposits be reinvested in Texas loans. Our domestic banking industry is virtually owned by out-of-state ownership. Chemical Bank, First Interstate, NCNB, Bank One out of Ohio. Counsel for the appellate says there's no proof in the record that this will put us at a commercial disadvantage. On page 6 of our brief, we cited language indicating that when variable rate notes were made non-negotiable in Chicago, it adversely affected the marketability of paper, and it made the cost of money to the consumer higher in the Chicago area because the paper did not have the characteristic of ease of negotiability. Under the circumstances, there is something in the record. There's also your common sense. If in Texas, as opposed to 27 other states now, and all the states have not spoken, so the fact that there are 27 who favor negotiability of variable interest rate notes does not mean that there are 23 opposed to it. It means that there are 3 that have gone on record as opposed to it. 27 now clearly favor negotiability. Is Texas going to step backward in time? Is it going to make it more attractive for the banks that now are collecting deposits in Texas to make the loans with that money in Louisiana or Oklahoma or California or New York or Ohio or Illinois? No. We respectfully urge that under the existing law, this may be interpreted, and this court is empowered by the legislature to consider what's necessary to modernize, to recognize current custom usage and the agreement of the parties, which here was plainly that these notes be conveyed to my client without defense. That is, that they be negotiable, that my client, when it acquired them, become a holder in due course. That was the intent of the parties, and it's that intent which the appellants are asking you to frustrate. This case should not be decided, though, on the intent of these parties. It's relevant to you. I hope you take it into consideration. But the question is too important for the state as a whole. The Fifth Circuit didn't certify the question to you whether the appellants or appellees ought to win this lawsuit. That's their problem. They certified to you a question as to what Texas law is at this court has been asked by the legislature to accept the guidelines in the Texas Government Code and the guidelines within the UCC to interpret, to keep this law current, vibrant, and alive, and keep it recognizing current commercial reality. Help us recognize that commercial reality. Keep us current. Do not make us competitively disadvantageous. This question should be answered in the affirmative.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Mr.
Counsel, can you tell us what commercial public policy would be offended by our holding as respondent request?
Yes. You would be stripping us Texas citizens of our rights under contract law, Texas contract law, for without hearing in the legislature, without appropriate legislative process. The whole purpose here of the bank is to strip us of our Texas contract law defenses and counterclaims. And I think that is offensive without the appropriate legislative representation. Representation or taxation without representation. In this case, stripping us of our defenses without representation. And I think that, obviously I stand here finding that very offensive.
Is it an important consideration in interpreting this code or any commercial law that Texas try to be in step with the majority trend in other states?
I absolutely agree. You have my 100% approval. It's very interesting. If you take Appley's brief and you look at his Appendix 7, he cites 19 states that have changed. Of the 19, he states that 18 of the 19 were changed by legislative action, not judicial action.
Well, does it make
I'm
any difference?
I'm absolutely in agreement that we should go with the nation.
Does it make any difference with how it was changed if our goal is to be in step with the mainstream of commercial practice?
I don't think our goal is necessarily to be in step with the mainstream of commercial practice. I'm very concerned about that approach. I'm concerned because, like a pendulum, commercial practice goes one way and comes back the other. I think our purpose as judges and lawyers in the law is to have that mainstream so that of what's right and wrong, so that wherever that pendulum of commercial practice goes, they can count on us to keep it right. Now, I'm deeply concerned that we understand that crime rates are totally disapproved by the commercial market today. In fact, casual conversation with bankers will tell you they don't like crime rates. There's been a lot of litigation over it. The crime rate for one person, crime rate for me is different from crime rate for General Motors at the exact same bank. There's been a lot of litigation on that very topic. Crime rates, no one that I know of in the commercial market likes crime rate. It's just convenient. The European countries, like the French bank, they don't use prime at all. London doesn't use prime. London uses the official government rate as their index. And in fact, very interesting, because the Goss case, the Oklahoma Supreme Court, decided on a Federal Reserve Bank issued rate, another government rate, a government published rate.
So it makes a difference to you that this is a private entity's prime rate, let's say, as opposed to a T-bill rate?
Certainly.
If it were a T-bill rate, it would not defeat negotiability here. Is that what you're saying?
No, not necessarily, but that's not the issue before the court.
I want to know what the difference is, since your argument is that it has to be ascertained from the four corners of the document, why it would be different if it were a United States government T-bill rate as opposed to a private lender's rate.
Because the source of the information is absolute. The federal government issues the rate. They publish it every day in the Federal Reserve Bank. Publication of the Federal Register.
Well, is it that you cannot ascertain? Is it that you cannot ascertain with as readily what the private lender's rate would be?
Well, there is no independent source of information on prime rates.
You can call them on the phone, ask them what's your rate today?
I have enough trouble calling them on the phone and getting them to fix my account problems. If you call a bank officer on the phone and say, what's your prime rate, he's going to say, how much do you want to borrow and what's your credit? Because prime rates fluctuate from customer to customer. The bank to bank, they fluctuate. And in fact, as I mentioned, there is a lot of litigation on that topic, although it's not in our brief, on that very topic, where under RICO and other things, the banks have been sued for having flaky prime rates.
But our question is a bank's published prime rate. That's all we're supposed to decide.
I understand. So
both of you all want
to
consider facts favorable to you and not consider the ones unfavorable, it seems.
I wholly agree.
But our statement is a bank's published prime rate.
Okay. Now, a bank's published prime rate is anything that's in their bank lobby. Okay? I mean, it's published.
Counsel, is it really relevant who sets the rate if the rate is set outside the four corners of the document? Unless a note is a form of contract, and unless the parties to the contract have notice that some rate of interest outside the note itself is going to be applicable, and they have statutory notice that it's going to be negotiable even under those circumstances. Here, apparently, custom and practice, tradition within the state at least, has been that it's not negotiable if that rate's determinable in reference to some outside authority. And they're asking to change it midstream. The legislature determined that policy. The legislature carved, whether it's an exception or not, I'm not sure, based on what the other side argued, but they at least put a dip in that doctrine, but they did it legislatively.
That is correct, Your Honor. The Goss case is Oklahoma.
If we're going to give the world notice, then it needs to be done through due deliberation and the legislature, which adopted the Uniform Commercial Code. The court didn't adopt it. The legislature did.
in the Virginia court, in the Taylor case, the Virginia Supreme Court in Taylor, as opposed to Goss, said it's for the legislature to have hearings and discussions and all those things necessary to make a rational rule. It is not for the court. So the Supreme Court of Virginia said it's not for us. It's non-negotiable. That's Taylor versus Roe.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
Everybody, please rise.